how you feel directly, not from just maybe driving by and seeing or hearing about it on Facebook, but yeah, have you wanted to have direct contact with her?
I am working on that as the next step, but I wanted to do this in timing with the Williams Lake marching and to show in solidarity that it's not an isolated feeling. But I did meet with Sharon Hartwell in January and specifically talked about like the queer community, specifically trans people, and what it meant to support trans rights versus to attack trans rights. I would love people to understand that transgender people are people just like themselves, and what goes on with their transness has nothing to do with you. It's not your business. Don't be involved. You don't want other people being involved in your very personal and medical situations, yeah. So don't be involved in others.
As Rashawn mentioned in our interview, the bill was narrowly defeated, but when searching for more information on this bill and without speaking to MLA Hartwell, I thought it might be prudent to share audio from BC Legislature's October 8th session, where this issue was brought up and later voted on. The voices you hear are Nikki Sharma, who represents the electoral district of Vancouver Hastings as a member of the BC NDP, and who serves as Deputy Premier and Attorney General of British Columbia, who does not support the bill, and also the voice of Vancouver Quilchina MLA Dallas Brody of the One BC Party in support.
Leader of the Fourth Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. World-renowned child advocate Christopher Elston has informed us that a private gender clinic in Vancouver is performing double mastectomies on healthy girls as young as 14 years old. 14. Mr. Speaker, my question through you to the Premier is this. How can he possibly allow this to continue?
Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have to say this is another sad day in the BC Legislature when conservative politicians are trying to dictate what parents should be doing and decisions they should be making with love and support for their children. And we're picking on vulnerable children. Let me be clear about something. Health decisions, individual health decisions for kids are a protected right of parents to make with their doctor in the best interests of their children, not by governments and not by politicians. I want to also say something, that gender identity is protected under the BC Human Rights Code, and that was unanimously passed in this legislature. I also want to say, it's not a surprise that this is in the House now, that we debate these things, picking on vulnerable kids. We have a party in the opposition that decided their tent was so big that it included intolerance, racism, and hate. MLAs across the aisle are leaders in their community, and when they tolerate it in their party, they tolerate it in this province, and they bring it to the House. Mr. Speaker, we are a party that believes in human rights. We believe in defending the rights of all individuals to live a dignified life in this province and to be protected by our Human Rights Code. We believe that we shouldn't be picking on vulnerable kids and the decisions that their parents make with their doctors. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Member. Member has supplemental.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, thank you. Just this morning, I spoke with a father who's here today, who is fighting to protect his 8-year-old son. His boy was encouraged at school to believe he was actually a girl. Teachers used a new name and pronouns and kept it secret. Now, a psychologist is already discussing puberty blockers despite having never met the child. My question through you, Mr. Speaker, to the Premier, what do you have to say to parents who are justifiably enraged by the reality that under your direction, schools are transitioning children behind their backs?
Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Spreading disproven conspiracy theories to spread fear and misinformation that targets vulnerable kids when those decisions should be made by their parents with the love and support that they provide them and the doctors. I think I've spoken before about how we really disagree with this type of politics. And we're really sorry that to all those people out there and the families out there that are going through this and supporting their loved ones and the kids out there that are hearing this, I'm sorry.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Thanks again to Pam Hassan for that piece from Smithers, BC and CSEK News. We are back with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're about 35 minutes into the hour and we are about due for a bit of a music break. This is from Stephen Ham Theremin Man, who's also a local Vancouver man. And this is his track, 2,000 Light Years From Home.
his bird note. 19 owls. That's how many species call the U.S. and Canada home. And while some, like this great horned owl, do go hoot in the night, the natural diversity of our 19 defy stereotypes. North America's owls range in size from the 4-pound snowy owl, which stands more than 2 feet tall, to the diminutive elf owl of the southwestern deserts, who weighs less than 2 ounces. The spotted owl inhabits deep, dark, old-growth forests, while the flammulated owl prefers open pine woods. And the short-eared owl floats over wide-open grasslands. All owls are carnivores, but their diets range from mammals the size of jackrabbits to insects like moths and crickets. Boreal owls hunt in total darkness, using only their hearing. Northern hawk owls hunt by sight in broad daylight. A few migrate with the seasons. Others remain on their territories year-round. 19 owls. 19 distinctive natural histories. You can learn more about all of them at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Once again, you are listening to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is your host, Danny Nesvedarani, and for the next piece of the hour, we are going to be going to Nanaimo, BC, because recently the Susnamo First Nation celebrated the formal return of land from the Crown. Specifically 194.7 acres of land being returned. This was something that happened earlier this month, and this piece was reported on by Lauren McKenzie of CHLY.
This is a CHLY news update. After decades of hard work and determination, 194.7 acres has been returned to the Snamuk First Nations. It was a celebratory morning at the Snamuk Recreation and Health Center on Thursday, October 16th, as members from Snamuk and the broader community gathered to hear the formal announcement of the returned land. Located adjacent to Vancouver Island University and above the nearby Nanaimo Parkway, 3 federal parcels of the former Department of National Defense land has been added to the Snamuk First Nations reserved lands. The 194.7 acres, or 78.8 hectares of land, will be part of the First Nations Tetuxen site. Tetuxen is a traditional name of Mount Benson, which means grandmother of all surrounding mountains. Snamuk Chief Mike Wise and Federal Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations, Rebecca Alty, made the joint announcement on Thursday. Chief Wise announced the return of land as historic.
This is the moment our people have worked towards for generations. We did it, and we did it together.
The land is part of the territory that has been progressively taken from the First Nations by colonial governments starting in the mid-1800s. This formal announcement for the land transfer comes after the ministerial order was signed in September. Over the past 2.5 years, members of the First Nations have given feedback on what they would like to see the Tetuxen site be turned into. Wise says, based on what they heard, the land will be used for mixed-use development, with low, medium, and high-density housing, commercial spaces for businesses, and cultural and recreational spaces. Wise says this land transfer has been a long time coming after his late mother and former Snamuk chief, Viola Wise, was told by the then-conservative-led government that the land would never be returned. Auntie Vi, as she was known by some, passed away in 2009.
We will continue advancing reconciliation with the Crown as we build a strong future for Snamuk, for the ancestors, and for all connected to these sacred lands. This achievement belongs to all of us.
With the land transfer, the Department of National Defense will be able to maintain its current facilities located across Nanaimo Lakes Road from Colliery Dam Park. The lower portion of the land transfer was previously the location of the Nanaimo Indian Hospital that operated from 1946 to 1967, where many Indigenous people were subject to unfit care and abuse. Wise says they are celebrating the pre-development process so they can address the harms that the hospital had and move forward with the land into a place of healing and recovery. Minister Alti says today is an historical day and a big step forward for reconciliation. The land transfer also comes after the federal government and Sinaymuc signed the Tetuxen Village Pacific Plains Settlement Agreement at the beginning of this year. This agreement saw the government provide the nation $42 million for what the minister says is the Crown's failure to set aside village lands promised in the Sinaymuc-Tsarlequin Treaty of 1854.
Now, whether it's the settlement or the addition to reserve, in both of these cases, your nation was unjustly deprived of the use and benefit of the lands. But now, thanks to the strength and determination of your leadership, that injustice has been resolved, and we've taken another step on the path of reconciliation.
After the announcement, Wise spoke to the media. Wise says the land transfer will have a significant impact on the community.
Oh, very significant. You know, our land base has been very small to live for our people, our growing nation. So to have this property brought forward for Sinaymuc is very significant. We've had the smallest land base per capita in BC. So for how to get lands back that's going to provide for our nation members to come home and potentially set roots here in Nanaimo is significant.
He says while they're looking at partnerships to help fund future projects, right now they are focused on the early stages of development and next steps. Wise says on this historic day, he is proud to be able to finish the work his mother first set out to do.
You know, we always fall back on the work that she started. It feels like we're bringing some of these items across the finish line for her. And she was a very strong leader for our community and a very strong trailblazer. So thankful. Oh, she'd be hooting and a hollering. She'd be very happy today and thankful.
Sinaymuc members will have a chance in December to vote on what they would like to see the land used for during the First Nations next general election. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Once again, thank you to Lauren McKenzie for that piece, and thank you to CHLY. Coming up next, we have an interview that I did about a week ago with a nonprofit organization that, while based here in BC, is sort of Canada-wide now, and they go by the name The Fur Bearers. They are a wildlife protection advocacy group, and recently, they advocated for the city of Burnaby to enact a wildlife feeding bylaw. This came as a result of a report that SFU specifically had put out saying that the reported amount of wildlife feeding and the unfavorable behavior of, you know, local raccoons at the university campus as a result of the wildlife feeding was becoming quite a problem, and that the amount of reports they'd been receiving had reached over 100. So the Fur Bearers, in collaboration with SFU, put together this report, this letter, and then sent it to Burnaby City Hall. And I spoke with a member of the Fur Bearers on this decision and what it represents. Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nazvatarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The Fur Bearers are a Canada-wide nonprofit based in British Columbia that focuses on the welfare of wildlife and how humans and animals can more sustainably coexist. On September 25th, the organization sent a letter to Burnaby City Council highlighting the need for a wildlife feeding bylaw in the city of Burnaby. This letter was supported by Simon Fraser University, which recently reported over 100 complaints filed on its Burnaby campus regarding raccoon behavior and activity in the last 2 years. They attribute these complaints to persistent feeding of the raccoons by some of the general public on campus, And while the university is claimed to have utilized numerous educational tools to communicate the importance of not feeding wildlife, its current methods are not having the desired effect. For this reason, the fur bears, alongside SFU, are advocating for a bylaw to be passed that would allow for enforcement action to address the issue of wildlife feedings on campus and throughout the city of Burnaby. To learn more about the bylaw, as well as what this proposed enforcement may look like, CJSF spoke with Tiana Selleck, the Fur Bears Wildlife Campaigns and Advocacy Manager, on how this bylaw proposal came to be.
So this is something that both the Fur Bears and SFU itself are really behind. The university has let us know they've received over 100 complaints in the past 2 years about people feeding raccoons on campus. Our organization has also had community members reach out to us for support. Like you mentioned, lots of students on campus who are encountering wildlife, witnessing feeding events. And then there have also been unfortunate incidents nearby, like the black bear that was killed near SFU in September after becoming food conditioned. So these are all really clear examples of how feeding creates problems. So by supporting our call for a municipal bylaw, SFU is essentially recognizing the importance of equipping the city with a necessary mechanism to help them address the issue.
Next, we asked what they hope this bylaw is able to accomplish.
So the goal here really is to change behavior. Typically, enforcement starts with education-based warnings. So giving people a chance to understand why feeding wildlife is harmful and adjust their actions accordingly. And what we hope is that once people understand that feeding of wildlife does pose risks and harms these animals long term, we're hoping that the behavior changes. But if it continues, the bylaw would give officers the ability to issue tickets as a deterrent to stop that behavior before it escalates into a bigger issue like we saw with that bear. So right now the city is relying on education alone, and it hasn't been successful in solving the problem. So this next step of enforcement is essentially just providing a necessary tool to shift that behavior in a way that will protect both the community and the wildlife within it.
Afterwards, we discuss what some of the negative effects are when it comes to feeding wildlife, whether it be on SFU's Burnaby campus or throughout the city.
So the biggest thing is feeding wildlife, whether that's directly or indirectly by leaving food out. It's teaching these animals to rely on people for food. They're also losing their natural and frankly necessary caution of us, which can lead them to bolder and riskier behavior, such as approaching people for food in the future, approaching people's homes, that sort of thing. Additionally, other wildlife may be drawn into the area, resulting in overcrowding. Like you mentioned, lots of wildlife on the campus. Also increased disease transmission from us to them and vice versa. And ultimately a higher likelihood of negative human wildlife encounters that unfortunately often end fatally for the animals involved. So it's just, it's unsafe for both people and wildlife long-term.
At the end of our conversation, Tiana Selleck left us with this piece of advice.
So we understand that the intention often comes from a good place, and feeding wildlife might feel like it's helping, but it really does harm animals. It's putting them at risk of injury, malnutrition, disease, and ultimately being destroyed. So true compassion means doing what's best for the animal long term, and the best way to care for wildlife is to let them stay wild. So what people can do that will make a really big difference is giving wildlife their space, not leaving food unattended on campus or in parks, properly storing away their garbage and their compost, and removing any attractants like pet food or bird feeders, that sort of thing. So really important not to feed them intentionally or unintentionally and to allow them to stay wild. And what we would really encourage people to do is continue to enjoy wildlife, but in a way that's compassionate and respectful. So this could be things like birding, volunteering with local rescues, engaging in citizen science initiatives, and supporting wildlife-friendly policies. So lots of great ways to enjoy wildlife that ensure safe coexistence for us and for them down the line.
Once again, that was our conversation with Tiana Selleck, the Wildlife Campaigns and Advocacy Manager for the Fur Bears, who are currently advocating for a wildlife feeding bylaw in the city of Burnaby. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. Thank you so much for listening to that interview. Once again, this is Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you again all for listening this hour. We've reached the very end of this episode, but before I end off, I'm going to be playing a track from another group that is a favorite here at CJSF, Empanadas Ilegales. And this track goes by the name of Matador. Make sure you stay tuned. We have a lot of great programming today, whether that be Democracy Now!, which is coming up just in a few minutes, or Typically Tuesdays. There's a lot going on today, so make sure you stay tuned.